Stay connected this winter with this unbeatable deal from Breezeline. Get reliable, fiber-powered internet for just $19.99 per month with all-in pricing for 2 years. But that's not all. Your first month is on us. This deal gets better with a free modem and installation, along with free Wi-Fi your way whole home coverage. Safeguard your network from cyber threats and keep all your devices connected and secured with this amazing offer. Act now. Terms and conditions apply. Offer expires March 3rd, 2024. Learn more at breezeline.com.
I would just like to say from the jump, the fact that Joker has won back-to-back MVPs, that's an indictment. That means Joel Embiid, Giannis Antetokounmpo are not very good players, even though they came in second and third place in the NBA voting for this award.
Thanks a lot, Mike. That's been Take Line for today. We're going to shut it down right here, and that's going to be the soundbite for the show.
Appreciate it. All right. It was fun, guys.
Hello and welcome to Take Line, another great show for you folks. Today I will be joined by, I call him Daddy. He is the very funny CJ Toledano, who also happens to be host, comedian extraordinaire. Together we are going to talk to John Hollinger, one of the most notable and kind of important basketball voices, I think, in the last couple of decades. Oh, we'll be talking to Nuggets beat reporter Mike Singer about Nikola Jokic's second MVP award in a row. But first, CJ and I are going to be joined by producer Ryan Wallison to just talk about last night's NBA games. Let's start with Game 4, Boston Celtics, Milwaukee Bucks. Celtics win 116-108. Series is tied 2-2. Al Horford coming out of the fucking crypt, 35 years old. Carried them for most of the game until Jason Tatum got his shit together. Dunked on Giannis. He hit him in the face a little bit. But just an unbelievable performance by him. And these last couple of games, I thought, with from the Bucks, you really felt, even though the Bucks won Game 3, you really felt Chris Middleton's absence down the stretch. What did we think of this game, and what do we think of Al Horford, like the rejuvenation of Al Horford?
God, can we just say, I mean, the beginning of these playoffs, people had to be reminded that Al Horford was back on this team. Like, people felt like they were in a coma and woke up and he had never left. And it feels like he's never left. And you know what? As a Celtics hater,
I am
rooting for the Bucks for this whole postseason, I'm really, really happy to see what Al Horford, it's incredible.
So Giannis dunked on Horford earlier in the game and got attacked for staring him down, which I always hate. Let guys stare each other down. It's fucking great. Let them trash talk. I love it. And who doesn't love it? It's fantastic. But anyway, his sister then later tweeted like, oh, I could tell by the look on Al's face right there that it was like a switch had flipped. I always love shit like that. And then later Al like praised God for basically, you know, during the post game was like, you know, it's all because of him. It's all because of God. I always love stuff like that because it's like one, the idea that Al would have needed that. He needed somebody to be like kick sand in his face, like the proverbial 90-pound weakling of old, to like Hulk out and get to that level. And then I always love whenever anybody's like, oh, I praise God, because it's like God was like, you know what? Fuck Giannis and the Bucks today. I don't like them. I'm going with my guy Al Horford. This is what happens in the playoffs, right?
Yeah.
You always expect it. You always expect the superstars to come through, which is why Jason Tatum's struggles over the last couple games and even this game have been notable. But there's always going to be that random game where somebody who Eddie House, Al Horford, some guy you didn't expect, was not on the radar at all, comes through and goes huge. And we're kind of waiting for that from the Bucks outside of Giannis, and they're going to need that in this home stretch of that playoff series. What do we make of Jason Tatum's struggles in this series?
You know, I think that as much praise as we heaped on him for as well as he did in the Nets series, he's kind of come down to earth. It's kind of like, oh, so he's not just top five all the time.
Yeah.
Okay. We've been looking at him struggle, obviously, with facing a better roster, a better overall like superstar in Giannis. And the offense and the defense that was on display again in the Brooklyn series, you know, on the offensive side, his shots just aren't falling. Like even in this game four, people called it a rebound, but 30-something points on 24 shots is still a tough, it's a tough stat line when you're looking at it from an efficiency standpoint.
Absolutely. I mean, he came through in the fourth quarter is when he started to really put it on. But up to that point, he was like 4 of 21, according to Kirk Goldsberry, through game three up until about the third quarter of game four. At one point, like, he was 0 for 10 when Wes Matthews was his primary defender, which is listen, Wes Matthews is nice. I like Wes Matthews. He's a solid player. But for a player of Jason Tatum's caliber, it's not a thing that we thought would matter. And I think you're right. Like, we're just kind of seeing a difference in the physicality level. And we've watched Jason Tatum take a leap over these playoffs. And here's another obstacle that he's going to leap over. This kind of like very, very physical. Because there's times watching this series where I'm like, holy shit. Like, they're letting this go. And I can't believe they're letting it go.
And I think that fans want Jason Tatum to be this superstar that we almost over celebrate his game winners, his big games. But to be the superstar that everyone is making him out to be, you have to be consistently carrying that team. You can't have, you know, you can have Jaylen. I mean, this is the reason why they're the number two seed, is because they have a Jaylen Brown who can carry. And now Al Horford being the star of this past game, like, we need to hear Jason Tatum's name more than we're hearing it now. And so, yeah, I think that's what's going to get to his next level. Can he consistently do this, or he can't just disappear as much as he is in this series?
I think, yeah.
I totally agree, but I think that the depth of the Celtics has really been on display. Like, we're talking about a game where Jaylen Brown was in foul trouble and didn't play most of the fourth. Jason Tatum, we're talking about his struggles, but we're also talking about a game where Al Horford absolutely went crazy and Marcus Smart contributed 18 points of his own. So that's 50 points between Horford and Smart. So you're really seeing the role players pick up the slack for the superstars. And I remember when we had Chris Mannix on a couple of weeks ago to react to game one of the opening series, and Horford had a great performance in that game as well. And we asked him, is Horford going to be able to sustain this throughout the postseason, or are the wheels going to fall off at some point and leave Boston kind of exposed? And now we're halfway through the second and Horford's still making that noise. So Mannix said that he wasn't worried about him, and Horford's making him look good right now.
Yeah, I've been watching the games with my 65-year-old white father-in-law. And this is he gave the perfect description on accent, just very naturally. We're watching the game. Al Horford was taking over, and he goes, Horford, solid player. Like, he is just, his game is so basic and straight up. The wheels can't fall off when it's just mid-ranges and just being in the right spot. So, like, I'd bet on Horford for the rest of, you know, this postseason as far as they go.
Yeah, to your point about depth, Ryan, Derek White for the Celtics, like, in terms of playing defense, moving the ball, like, making the right play, he was plus 18, only 11 points, 4 rebounds, 3 assists, but, like, just making the right play every time. And I think you contrast that with, like, some of the Bucks supporting staff, like Drew Holiday, his counting stats, like 16 points, 9 assists. That's great. Minus 23 plus minus, and just, you know, 5 of 22 from the field. And you know, Grayson Allen has appeared like unplayable at times. It's just, you're absolutely right, Ryan. Like, the depth around Giannis just needs to be, we just need more solid play. Bobby Portis is like hardly playing. Lopez has been solid, but they just need more. They just need more. The Celtics depth is really showing right now. Let's move on to Warriors, Memphis, game four. A lot of talk around this series, a lot of narrative around this series, a lot of acrimony, a lot of toxicity. Golden State eked out the win 101-98. Golden State didn't lead until the last 45 seconds of this game, to let you know what a very, very strange game it was. Steve Kerr tested positive for the novel coronavirus COVID-19 and went into health and safety protocols like minutes before the game. Mike Brown, who that day was announced as the new head coach of the Sacramento Kings, then got another promotion to head coach of the Golden State Warriors. Of course, no Ja Morant, whose vague knee injury with MRI results that are being hidden from the public, did not play. And again, Golden State goes on to win a 3-1 series lead. My takeaway from this game is if Dylan Brooks had not been suspended, this series would be fucking over. Dylan Brooks, this guy will not let his opponent rest. Like, is such an active, chaotic defender. But this guy put in maybe the worst 6-minute stretch of basketball this playoffs down the stretch of the game, where it was like triple jab step, drive, kick the ball out of bounds, like a three-pointer with like early in the shot clock, no extension on his arm, like the weirdest three-point form where the ball sails completely over the rim, hits off the other side of the backboard. Just crazy shit from Dylan Brooks. He played 39 fucking minutes, and the Warriors take it. I think he was the difference in the game. Like, the Warriors should give him the fucking game ball. What did we think of this game, fellas?
I mean, can more shit happen in a series? Like, truly... Yeah. Every 5 minutes, something new surfaces. But you're right. It was like watching Julian Newman play in the NBA with Dylan Brooks. It's funny. It's like, you know, I don't know if there was a pregame speech and they were like, we needed someone to step up. And Dylan Brooks like thought that was supposed to be him.
Oh, it's me. Right.
Yeah.
I'm stepping. Okay.
But I mean, I was really surprised. I mean, the reason why I think the Grizzlies led most of that game was because, I mean, the Warriors shot horribly. They scored, what, 38 points?
Mm-hmm. Terrible.
Clay is not Clay. He hasn't been Clay this whole series. So, yeah. Like, all that to only be leading by, like, what, 2 or 3 at the half? So, it kind of just, like, it worked out the way it should have worked out. I thought a masterful Steph Curry ending there in Draymond. Yeah. That flop, I'm sure that's going to be a major part of this conversation, but that flop was, it's the type of flop where I watch it and I learn something new every time on every replay. Truly hilarious, but truly an expert at the move.
Now, CJ, you're so right, man. The Warriors came out of the gate shooting horribly, 0-for-15 from three until Otto Porter hits with 4.5 minutes before the half.
Again, there's that thing where you're just looking for some guy that's gonna carry you for a stretch, and Otto Porter was that guy for this game.
You know, when you're 0-for-15, I'll let the ball boy carry me if he can get the shot in. But you know, it was funny because watching Memphis lead the game the entire time, I was thinking about the conversation we had at the start of this series, where we were like, you know, these games are gonna be close, but Golden State is going to win all of the close matchups. You know, there was the blowout in reaction to the Ja Morant injury in Game 3, but all the other games have been very closely contested. Memphis was able to eke out, you know, a victory in Game 2, but Games 1 and 4 were kind of those situations where we know Memphis is a good team, but we also know that Memphis is a young team. And, you know, we know exactly where Golden State has been. We know who they are. And they showed that in both of those games. And we said, these are going to be close games that Memphis doesn't win any of them. And I think that it's played out that way. And I expected the gentleman sweep that we called to come to fruition.
After the game, Taylor Jenkins, one of the most curious coaches in the NBA, he was, of course, curious about the play that the Grizzlies allege caused Ja Morant's injury. Talk about that in a second. But he said that he was curious to see what the last 2-minute report will say about Draymond Green's late contest on Jaren Jackson's 3, which I think, I don't know if it was a shooting foul. I think you could make the argument that it was. All of which is to say, I think the Grizzlies remind me of the early 2000s Kings, in that the Kings were trying to unseat the Lakers, the great Kobe Shaq Lakers, right? And who can forget when Phil Jackson called Sacramento a cowtown, and then the Kings fans responded with all the cowbells, and they made it one of the loudest arenas ever. But I felt like in retrospect, the Kings got so wrapped up in this narrative of the Lakers are the kings of the NBA and we're the underdogs. Everybody is against us. The entire league is against us. The refs are against us. And we're just like out here scrapping for anything we can get. Like, you know, and I feel like the Grizzlies got a little bit rattled by Kerr's the code talk. And I think they responded poorly to it. And I think they have gotten a little bit, they're getting a little exposed in terms of their inexperience. And I think they got a little wrapped up in the whole narrative of them being the underdogs, everybody being against them. And everything that has happened after that has kind of not been great. The suggestion that Jordan Poole pulling on Ja's knee late in game three is what caused Ja's knee injury or exacerbated it. Of course, Ja has a history of right knee injuries, missed a number of games over the course of the regular season with a right knee injury, plays an extremely bruising, contact-laden style in which he is constantly like knifing towards the rim and taking contact and jumping over guys, had knocked knees seemingly earlier in the game, previous to the play that Taylor Jenkins references. I just think that, like, if you're going to seriously say that Jordan Poole caused that and do it in a the casual tone of it doesn't match up. Like, if I'm saying this opposing player, like, on purpose reached down and injured my best player, then I'm doing it with so much anger, if that's legit, that I'm not even talking about basketball. I'm like, we need to call the police that this happened. Are you kidding me? Like, how? And it just is, it feels like they're trying to answer the gamesmanship of Kerr when he brought the code thing into it, which I didn't love. I don't love suggesting that a player tries to injure a player on purpose. I think that basically that never happens. Like, Bill Laimbeer aside, and maybe Bruce Bowen, I don't believe that there's ever been an NBA player that has on purpose gone out there trying to hurt. I think guys just get reckless. Maybe they lose their head for a second, but I don't think anybody is ever trying to hurt anybody. But, like, not letting Dylan Brooks talk, like, keeping him from the media for as long as they did, I think that made it seem like they had something to hide. Let Dylan just come out and say, hey, it's unfortunate that happened, and I'm saddened that that happened. Go right back at Kerr when he says the code stuff and say, hey, we play hard. And I know that Taylor Jenkins did kind of say stuff like that, but, like, go right back at him and say, you have Draymond Green on your team. Like this is just, we're playing hard-nosed. It got away from Dylan Brooks, and that's unfortunate, but the suggestion that we do anything untoward is kind of rich coming from a team that employs Draymond Green. Like, go hard at him there, but don't respond in this weird kind of sensitive way where you're hiding Brooks from the press, and then all of a sudden you're suggesting that Jordan Poole, like, injured Ja Morant on purpose. It just has been this kind of weird flailing response, and I feel like it has exposed the Grizzlies a little bit mentally. Like, this should be a learning experience for them.
Can we just recap the context of, if that was a supposed on-purpose attack on Ja Morant's knee, where it's like they're leading by, I forget how much they were up by in
they
that
were up
game
by,
at that point.
They were killing him at that point. Yeah.
They were killing him at that point. It's 1-1 early in the series, guys. If you're going to put a hit on Ja Morant, you're not going to have Jordan Poole do it. You're going to have some guy, some Russian dude off the bench in the movie version of this all.
Right, the movie.
And he would, you know, and then expect them to do some, like, legendary, the Drunken Master, like, 5-point knee, tear 8 ligaments. It's impossible and unlikely. It was the beginning of that. It just started this domino effect of, like you said, the Grizzlies kind of exposing their inexperience to the game of it all, not just on the court. It's
right.
Hey, how do you respond in these post-game press conferences when a question of, you know, sort of being baited? They fell for a lot of the bait. Taylor Jenkins, like Dylan Brooks, like, no, we're not going to have Dylan Brooks respond right away because we're this hard-nosed, scrappy team. You know, we've been in the media. We've been doing everything right. It's like, no, guys, like, at the end of the day, just like, you didn't do it on purpose. No one did that. The code, the code is, oh, we don't hurt people in games. There wasn't a code established. You just don't injure people. So I just, you know, the Grizzlies have been just straight up kind of weird. And I think it's them being young and somewhat immature and going like, no, this is the strategy. Let's just, you know, we're this hard-nosed team that doesn't, we're not soft. And it's just at this point weird.
And furthermore, Dylan Brooks, 39 minutes, like, I guess Taylor Jenkins is saying, like, I'm supporting my guys. These are the guys that brought us here. Dylan, of course, being an important cog in that and in what we did, our success, this, particularly when Ja was out, and that stretch that we of winning that we did when Ja was out. But like, D'Anthony Melton played 9 minutes. I think Zaire Williams could have done some stuff for them. And you're talking about guys who are going to bolster you defensively and not make decisions that make you ask, like, does Dylan Brooks have money on this game going the other way? Like, it just feels like there were some buttons and levers that could have been pushed and thrown that didn't get going. Ryan, do you have any thoughts about this?
When you're in this position, it's kind of all hands on deck. And I thought that they definitely could have employed more of their roster to try to get this game, because this was another situation, like I said before, where they were very close to getting this win. This was a winnable game for them. And just to be that far from, you know, the promised land, the proverbial promised land of the night, is just, when you look back at the tape, when you look back at the minutes, when you look back at the rotations, if you didn't empty the clip and to try to get that attainable victory, then I think there's always going to be a sense of regret there. So when you know, this game is over and that regret already exists, when the series is over, I think they'll look back and they'll say, you know, outside of that Game 3, we weren't very far away. I think that's part of the immaturity. I think that's part of the experience that we always said was going to be really good for Memphis.
I should add that before the game, Dylan Brooks finally spoke to the press. It had been 5 or 6 days or something like that, and said, you know, it's paraphrasing now, but like, you know, if I could do it all over again, like, obviously, like, I would not have made that foul, and he feels bad about it. You can, you know, whatever people, you know, obviously Golden State fans are going to have an opinion about, like, the sincerity of that, but that shouldn't have happened 5 days later. Have him meet the press right away, take the fucking gas out of it, yeah. You know, deflate the tension around that, and don't let Steve Kerr rattle you by suggesting that you're a dirty squad. Like, go back at him. And that is maybe something they'll do for next time.
I think the waiting is what gives Golden State fans the right and the leeway to question the, you know, the sincerity of it. Because at this point, it seems like someone just pushed him out onto the stage and said, no, you have to say it.
Yeah.
As opposed to him just coming out and doing the right thing.
Yeah, it was just all around weird. Finally, let's talk about, we're going to talk with Nuggets beat reporter Mike Singer, of course, about this. But let's talk about Jokic and his second MVP. Philly fans are mad, and they're right. They are upset that Joel Embiid did not win an MVP award, despite being, he would have been my pick for MVP. It's a different kind of case than the statistical case that you can make for Nikola Jokic. But I'll say this. Nikola Jokic's regular season, 27 points on 58% shooting, which is crazy. 33% from a three-point range since 33 minutes. 27 points, 13 rebounds, basically 8 assists, steal and a half, 1 block a game. The advanced stats, as I'm sure everyone has heard, are incredible. But my kind of favorite thing about Jokic's MVP is that inherent in the case, and I've been watching Nuggets fans online do this for days, built into Jokic's case is a criticism of Nuggets players. It's like, man, Jokic is MVP, and you know why he's MVP? Because our fucking team sucks. These guys suck. Fuck these guys that we had. They were Jeff Green should have retired 3 years ago. Everybody else, terrible. Aaron Gordon, get him off my squad. It's just really funny to me. Who do you agree with Jokic winning his second in a row MVP?
I am bored of this conversation. I will talk about it. No, but it is like, let's talk, like, let's give this award at the end of the regular season. Cause that is the great reminder to a lot of people, this for the regular season. And the thing is, like, Embiid deserved it too. And they had to dig deep to give this award to Jokic. And I think just the main, just general reaction is it's boring to give it to a player 2 years in a row. We've been wanting Embiid to be as good as he is, and he was this season with all that drama around him. And they are making, and we're watching him, you know, step up in these playoffs and be this Joel Embiid MVP player. And we're like, I think the big question is he going to be this way again? Is he going to continue to grow? And that's what we're all nervous. We're all nervous that he won't be, and that he won't get it. And then we'll talk back on 2022. The year Embiid deserved to be the MVP, and we didn't give it to him.
I got to give it up to Kendrick Perkins, because rarely do I have to give it up to Kendrick Perkins. But I thought Kendrick actually had a good point, which is he said today on Swagoon Perk, I don't know what the criteria for MVP is, but I do know that story should matter, and nobody had a better story than Embiid this season. So the NBA, very, very smartly, has never defined what MVP means, right? So every year it is a discussion and a redefinition by various parties about what it means to be the MVP, right? I think you can make a very, like, obviously the statistical case, the winning case, the on court, off court, case for Jokic is super strong. Like, he's great. You can watch him and you're like, he's great. He's a 7-foot Magic Johnson, like, who's also like an incredible low post player, who's also like the best passing big man of all time. For Joel Embiid, he is like the difference maker for the Sixers. He is doing it on both ends, defensively and offensively. He's one of the most devastating low post players that we have in the game. And more to the point, I just think the stuff that he's had to deal with the whole Ben Simmons drama, with what they're going to do in terms of with the James Harden drama that comes inherently with adding him to the mix, with his own injury struggles. We're watching him right now play through the kind of like, the, you know, post-concussion symptoms, a shattered eye socket and a torn ligament in his thumb. And the history of injuries that he's had to deal with. And to your point, CJ, it's like, I worry that we won't get a chance to give it to him again, truly, which is why I wanted to give it to him this year. I thought he was deserving. I thought he's had a great story. This is a guy who missed 2 years of the early part of his professional career with injuries. And I just feel like, are we going to have a chance to give it to him again? I don't know. And that's why I thought he was my MVP this season.
And if we don't, if he ends his career without an MVP, just after a career of us calling him an MVP caliber player, I think we're going to regret that, especially when we look back at this back to back. Because even if Jokic had the, you know, statistically and numerically superior season, I think the fact that he is already the defending MVP, as you've said in different instances before, should take away, it should make it harder to win the second one. To go back to back, you should be like head and shoulders the best. It shouldn't, there should be no argument. That should be the only way you can win it. Otherwise, I think that they should divvy it out, because different guys deserve it.
And people will say, okay, but Jokic's stats are actually better this year. Like, he had great, you know, he was incredible the year before this, but he's actually even better now. To which I would say, Russell Westbrook was the year he won it, when he averaged a triple-double, he was kind of better the second year. He was better the second year.
Yeah.
And we didn't give it
There's
to him.
There's a precedent.
Yeah, you know, There's so I just think that, like, all of this changes. It's all about narrative is a bad word, but I think that it is all about narrative and the argument you make. And my argument for Joel Embiid was he is an MVP-level player. He is everything to the Philadelphia 76ers. He's had to deal with the kind of drama that Jokic has never had to deal with over his career, has had to battle his own body over the course of his career in a way that other players just haven't had to do. And he's great, 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 and a warrior. And I wish he had won it. That's all.
Yeah. What did you guys see? Winning Time in the finale. Did you guys see this?
Yes, I did see
the very factual, accurate Winning Time. There's that scene, and there's no spoilers. This happened But they were, you know, Kareem was the MVP of that series. But David Stern went up to Magic in the hallway and he goes, "Hey man, you played, this is your moment. If we can just make that part of the equation, whose moment is it?" And it's this season was Embiid's moment. You know, it's, you said narrative is a bad word. Maybe it's moment. It's like we were talking about Embiid this whole goddamn season. And plus the stats that were somewhat close to Jokic, I just think like that's enough. And I think that's what we just want going forward, is to just take account for stats, narrative, all aspects of what is going on in awarding these players. Because we've done it in the past. Let's just do it every season.
Here's Doc Rivers on Joel Embiid today, this morning. Quote, "I don't know if I could have done more than he did this year. Play without the second best player all year. His resume is great. I'm not taking anything away from Jokic either, because he's a hell of a player. I do think this whole analytic driven society world is out of control at times with some of the measures they use. Like, watch the dang game and decide, is what I've always said. But at the end of the day, if Joel had won, which I thought he should have, there would have been criticism that way. If Giannis had won, only one guy could win, unfortunately." I'll just say also, the criticism of Jokic as, you got to watch the games. I mean, you watch Jokic, he's fucking great. Yeah. And there's this like weird counter narrative where it's like, oh, only if you understand Vorp can you understand like what Jokic, you watch him and it's like, oh, that guy's, the Nuggets don't score unless Jokic assists on it or scores himself. Like, anyway, I thought it should have been Embiid, but here we are. Up next, John Hollinger.
March into spring with this unbeatable deal from Breezeline. Get reliable, fiber-powered 500 megabits internet for $39.99 per month, plus a $100 gift card and price lock guarantee. This deal gets even better with a free modem, free installation, and free Wi-Fi your way home. Safeguard your network from cyber threats and manage user access for all connected devices with this amazing offer. Act now. Terms and conditions apply. Offer expires May 6, 2024. Learn more at breezeline.com.
Second round of the NBA playoffs are in full swing, and it's Monday morning. Nikola Jokic has just been announced as the NBA MVP, his second straight MVP in a row. A lot of that discourse has centered on the importance of stats, in advanced stats in Nikola Jokic's campaign. And if you want to blame somebody for that, I've got no one better than the great John Hollinger, the inventor of PER, one of the great analysts in the history, in the modern history of the NBA. John, thank you for joining Take Line. It's great to have you here. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Super surprising games this weekend. I never in my life dreamed that that Phoenix Dallas would be 2-2. Same with Philly Heat. I never thought that would be a 2-2 series with the injuries that that Philly was dealing with throughout that series, with James Harden's seeming ongoing decline. What have been the big surprises that you've seen thus far in the playoffs?
Yeah, I mean, probably Dallas being 2-2 is probably the biggest one. Just the way those first two games went, especially, it just looked like Phoenix had them completely outclassed. And then they've gone to some of this stuff that worked against Rudy Gobert, and they're finding it works against DeAndre Ayton too, where they put five people around the three-point line. It's just really hard to help from there. So Phoenix's guards are better defensively than Utah's were, but it still really opens things up for not just Luka, but Jalen Brunson and Spencer Dinwiddie to get in the paint and create problems. And you almost wonder if they've found kind of the new cheat code for the NBA, and that a lot more teams are going to be doing this going forward.
You've seen people start talking about this, but like at some point, shouldn't the Suns just say, okay, Luka, go for 60 if you want? I remember like this is how teams used to play the old Nash Suns back during the playoffs. Go for 60 if you want, but we're going to stay home on all these 3-point shooters and not let them get off, because that is what is killing us. Do you expect Phoenix to do some version of that going forward?
It's a little hard. I mean, once you get a screen for Luka, you have to make a decision, right? And usually with Ayton, the decision is to have him play a drop. So now you're in a little more of a rotation situation where other guys can get involved. So it's an interesting quandary for the Suns. I personally, I like the idea of letting Luka go for 60 because I think he tends to burn himself out when he scores too much in the first half of games. We saw that certainly in game two. Yeah. So I like that idea from that perspective. And I do wonder if the Suns will lean more in that direction as this series goes on. But if you're doing that, you're probably asking your bigs to switch on him some, certainly more than they have. And that may result in them getting cooked too.
John, I had a question. So say hypothetically, the Mavs take this series. Uh-huh. I think everyone was kind of saying, oh, the Mavs are going to lose this series. So what do they got to do this summer? They got to go out and get a center. Say they make it past this series. Do you see the Mavs spending big on a center this summer?
Well, I don't see them spending big on a center either way because they can't. They're kind of locked into their salary structure. Now, if they do a trade, you know, they still have that Bertans contract clogging up their cap. So if they take that and a future pick and maybe trade for a center, that's a different discussion. But I do also wonder what type of center they would want, because I think the idea has always been, oh, we'll get somebody who's a really great lob threat and we'll pair that guy with Luka. Or the alternative, we'll get a great pick and pop guy, Porzingis, and put that guy with Luka. And I think that, you know, they're kind of going back toward the Porzingis model a little bit with how they're playing. They're just using Kleba in that role instead. So it is kind of interesting that they're tilting back toward just playing that perimeter model and not really having a rim runner next to Luka. I mean, Dwight Powell hasn't been playing that much in either of these two series. So it's an interesting decision for Dallas. I mean, I will say the other thing is, we get all excited when these series are tied 2-2. If you look historically, I mean, it usually, when the home team wins the first four games of a series, it way more often than not, the team with the better seed ends up advancing.
Well, speaking of that, let's talk about Philadelphia, Miami, another series that I never thought would have been 2-2. If Joel Embiid is healthy for that entire series, I'm surprised that it's 2-2. Considering he was out, I'm surprised that it was 2-2. But a lot of the discussion has to be about James Harden, who had a bounce back. I don't even know if you could. It's like calling Jesus coming out of the tomb after the 3 days a bounce back win for Jesus Christ, like on Easter Sunday. He would like. So Harden had a huge bounce back game.
Come
right?
on, this isn't like DeAndre. It's not DeAndre having 30, right? Like, come on,
I can't. We're surprised he scored 31.
I know, everybody. You know, and he said after the game, "Well, my shots are falling." I think that's a good analysis of what happened. It's not like he was driving past guys with the kind of liquid quickness that he has shown in the past. He was hitting some really really tough. Tough step back threes. He was so deep in his bag. It was really incredible. But what are you seeing in that series? And is it, can we say that James Harden is back? Should we apologize? Should I sign the apology form that is going around on the internet for all the people who declare James Harden washed? Must I apologize in written format now?
He's like 30% washed. Right? He's not what he was, but he still can help you win. Right.
Yeah. So,
and that, I mean, the funny thing about that series, it's been make or miss league. I mean, writ large, every single game, the losing team, every single game is like, wow, we were like 8 for 43 from three. Huh? And meanwhile, like yesterday you had Harden who hit a lot of really difficult threes off the dribble, as you say. And that was a real difference for Philly. I do think Philadelphia can win this series. I think Embiid, the biggest story of the last two games to me is that Embiid has completely snuffed out Bam Adebayo's offensive role. And so it just puts so much pressure on Jimmy Butler to do everything offensively for Miami. So I think that puts Miami in a little bit of a difficult spot. I'm interested to see what happens in game five when the home venue changes again. I'm really interested by this series now.
Hey, John, do you think this story coming out with Jokic this morning, do you think that affects the series at all in Embiid? Or, I mean, Embiid's playing great, but is there going to be a sort of a targeted comeback here?
Well, this isn't like Hakeem playing against David Robinson, right?
Yeah.
He's not like, I'll show you, Dwayne Dedman, you know? I don't see as much of that. And I think Embiid probably, I mean, I think everyone sort of knew Jokic was going to win and Embiid was going to come in second.
Yeah.
So I don't think this is like some big shock either. So it's hard for me to see it tilting things that way, but I mean, Embiid has been amazing regardless, right? So
yeah.
I just think he's a problem for Miami. And the other thing that makes him a problem is Miami loves to switch and put Bam on the perimeter guy, which once you do that, now you have, you know, Jimmy Butler or Tyler Hero or somebody trying to guard Embiid. So they've been pretty good about giving enough help to make the entry passes hard, but it's still like you're in a bad position for rebounding. You pick up fouls. Like there's just a lot that goes on when you do that.
You mentioned the make or missness of it. Jimmy Butler was everything offensively for the Heat this weekend, and not much else there that in terms of scoring that wasn't initiated by him. I half expected him to make his entire team like stay after and shoot baskets the way that he so often performatively does when he plays poorly. But I think there's been a lot of surprise that, like, you know, Duncan Robinson, owner of a $90 million contract, hasn't seen more time considering the dearth of scoring that the Heat are dealing with right now. What do you make of that? And do you expect to see Robinson at some point in this series?
Yeah, what was crazy is that he didn't even play in garbage time in game three when they opened they emptied their bench and put in everyone except Robinson. It was like, it was like a mafia rub out, right? Like it was like, what's going on here? You could see in the Atlanta series that they had a problem when they had Robinson and Hero on the floor at the same time, that it was just too easy to target one or the other. And if they were going to live with having one bad defending wing on the court, it was going to be Hero. That wasn't as much of an issue when they had Robinson in the starting lineup, but they basically found a better version of Robinson when they got Max Strus. And so he kind of pushed Robinson out of that role. I still think there are spots where they could have turned to him. Like they've been going with Gabe Vincent some. I think Robinson could help him more in those minutes, especially we'll see if Kyle Lowry plays, but If Lowry was on the floor already, or you had other ball handlers on the floor already, usually had either Lowry or Hero in the game, you can have Robinson out there, and I think he might give you more than Vincent would. But either way, I mean, even if he was playing, it would be in a diminished capacity, right? We're talking like 10 minutes as the eighth guy in the rotation. So bigger picture, and I wrote about this for The Athletic a couple weeks ago, when it was apparent that Victor Oladipo was going to be taking his time, because that's the other thing that happened is Oladipo didn't play all year, and now he's become one of their core guys. The like you said, they're sitting on this $90 million deal. I think that and Miami's next two first round picks on draft night becomes their bait for whatever star they go hunting for.
I have to ask you, as a former employee, front office person with the Memphis Grizzlies, what do you make of the way we are talking and that people are talking about that series now, with a number of notable hard fouls, starting with Draymond's ejection after the Brandon Clark foul and pull down, which some people called, I thought it was drastic but not unreasonable to eject Draymond there. Then, of course, you had the Dylan Brooks foul on Gary Payton II that sent Gary Payton II on the injured list. And who knows when we could see him again. And then, of course, Ja Morant's knee injury, which is being framed, you know, by Taylor Jenkins, coach of the Memphis Grizzlies, and others, other voices within the Grizzlies, as being directly caused by Jordan Poole, like, pulling on his knee. What do you make of the discussions around this series and that play in particular?
I mean, it's it's the playoffs and this, you know, this stuff is fun and everything. But like, there, I mean, the Jordan Poole play, like that was just total suspension fishing to me. Like it was a, it was a nothing play. And then, I mean, it, to be fair, like you had Warriors people online, like, oh, Desmond Bane dove into Poole's legs. It's like, no, he fell down. Like, what are you talking about? So anyway, it's we get series like this every year. I mean, this one was unusual because it started out physical right away. You had those incidents in the first two games. So the temperature's already turned up. And then you have Memphis's best player potentially not playing in game four now. Although they, like, they still won't say what's wrong with his knee.
Taylor Jenkins' quote is, I think it's likely that we probably won't see it. There's like multiple adverbs in the sentence. It's like unclear.
But it was the same thing when he was out at the end of the year. Yeah. You know, it was just knee soreness. And it was like, damn, this thing's been sore for a while. Like, are we sure that's all that's going on there? So that whole thing's been a little odd too. So I just think there's a lot of gamesmanship underlying it that you know, usually see in these playoffs. And it would be unfortunate for Memphis though, if Morant can't go, because he was the one thing, like, even as they were getting their butts kicked in game three, Golden State still didn't have a handle on him at all.
Yeah.
Do you guys feel like fans are really forcing these teams to hate each other when they just, like, there's not a real rivalry. I feel like no one hates each other. They're just both wildly energetic and scrappy teams.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I mean, the hatred and whatever you want to call it, I think is much more like at the fan level and at the, you know, and then competitively, like, these teams are doing what they're doing just to try to get an advantage. But like, I don't see, like, there's not the personal level hate that, like, when we played the Clippers in 2013, like that was much more personal. Let's put it that way.
Go Google the choke slam, the famed Zeebo choke slam, if for folks at home who want to get a taste of the viciousness of that particular series, which is super fun. Do you think if Kerr could go back in time, he would not say the code thing? Because I feel like that's whether he thinks that or not. Okay.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing that kind of pushed the discourse a little into the overheated side. Like, it's one thing to say that was a reckless play and one that clearly got away from Dylan Brooks. And we are so saddened for GP, who has, you know, been toiling on the fringes of the NBA and now found a home, and he's going to a free agency year. This is really devastating for him, yada, yada, yada. But I think to take it into the unwritten rules territory, it feels like that's as fair or unfair as you think that is. I think that's the thing that pushed this all over the edge.
I think it did a little bit, because when people hear that, they think of baseball. I wrote about this in The Athletic today, but they think about, like, baseball managers, like, losing their shit over a sacrifice bunt or something, you know, like that. No, there's an unwritten rule about that. You can't do that when the score is 8-3 in the eighth inning, you know? And so I thought it actually... He lost his message a little bit when he said the code, rather than just talking about the fact that the scariest thing for any basketball player is to get hit from behind. You have no control over it. You're going full speed and you're just going to land violently and hope nothing breaks.
The Memphis Grizzlies record without Ja this year, 16-2, quite good. On the other hand, they're playing a Warriors team that is not going to make mistakes in the way that the Minnesota Timberwolves made mistakes in the first round clash between Memphis and Minnesota that allowed Memphis to win that series. Assuming that Ja is out, which is unclear at this time, what do you see them doing? Where do they go for scoring?
That's probably the biggest question. They'll start Tyus Jones. They'll play Melton more. They'll have Dylan Brooks back. So defensively, they'll probably be more solid. I also wonder if they're going to bring back Steven Adams for game four into the starting lineup. I mean, they're not really getting anything out of Tillman anyway. So I think you just have to try to go back and be that team you were in the regular season, even if Adams isn't maybe tailor-made defensively for going against Golden State. And then if he's starting, he's not on the floor when Poole is, who has been their biggest problem. So he doesn't have to worry about switching onto Poole. They'd have Clark in the game by then. So I do wonder if they do that. The biggest thing, I mean, not having Jai, you're going to lose stuff offensively. It's can you get it back at the defensive end,
right,
by playing Jones more, playing Melton more, and just being more solid at that end, because that's Jai's biggest weakness. And that was one of the reasons that they were able to keep their heads above water when he was out of the lineup, is that the defense improved. So with all of that said, I just don't know how they're going to score enough without him. I think that's going to be a real problem. They're going to be counting on Brooks, who has not had a good playoffs, to be the Brooks that was averaging 25 against Utah last year. They need Jaren Jackson to stay hot from three, and they need to do this ensemble thing where nine different guys score 8 points and they end up with a bunch that way.
If Jaren Jackson stays on the floor, if he can stay on the floor throughout his career, how good can he be?
So all defense talent at the defensive end. I still think he can get to another level as a three-point shooter. I mean, he shot in the low 30s this year. The thing is, his footwork is so good for a big guy. Like, he can shoot coming off of pin downs and doing stuff that a lot of guys can't do. It's just the actual form with his arm sometimes it takes him astray. But you watch his feet, you're like, oh, my God. So I still think there's stuff he can get to there. And then the other big thing for him is he's all left off the bounce. And a lot of times when he does a show and go past the first, he doesn't see the second line of defense and he just trucks the help defender and picks up charging fouls that way. So for him to, I guess, have better court vision off the drip when he does put it on the floor and have a better right hand would probably be the two biggest things for him offensively. Defensively, I think the sky is the limit for him.
Yeah.
Even now, he picks up fouls in bunches, but they're not on defensive plays. He's not picking them up challenging shots at the rim. He's picking them up just to get his arm caught on somebody on a rebound or a random loose ball or, you know, offensive fouls and just the most random, bizarre ways that have nothing to do with his defensive role.
Chris Paul, he's 37. He'll have a game where he goes 14-14, and then he will seemingly go into like a deep energy-saving hibernation for a number of games. How can the Phoenix Suns get more consistent play out of him? And what is going on with him? Like, it has been really weird to watch him the last several games just kind of not affect the Suns in the way that you're used to seeing him. What, any idea like what exactly the Mavs are doing, or is it just like this guy's 37 and he can't bring it at a super high level game after game?
The first 8 games of the playoffs, the 6 games of the New Orleans series and the 2 of the Dallas, I think he had one bad game, and then the rest of the time he was awesome. So I thought he was having a tremendous playoffs up until these last 2 games, and then he, you know, hasn't quite been at that level, which I guess you'd sort of expect him to regress a little. I mean, him fouling out obviously was kind of a surprise, and the way he fouled out certainly. But he's never, I mean, Booker is the high volume guy on that team, and Paul has always played kind of the number 2 role in their offense. And sometimes he steps it up and picks his spots. Sometimes he, like you say, I mean, he kind of hibernates for a half or longer and then dials it up in the fourth quarter. He wasn't really around for the fourth quarter yesterday, so he couldn't do that. But I just think that's his tempo and that's how he plays now and that's how he manages himself through a game. It just we didn't really get to see the second half Chris Paul yesterday because he had no second half. I think he played like 3 minutes total in the second half yesterday.
Well, and just going by like when he was on the Rockets, it feels like though, like say he doesn't bounce back from this, there's a bit of like he feels like he conquered the mountain mid-series on some of these things. Do you think there's any possibility that that's a reality? That he almost peaks too early?
Oh, in a series? I'm trying to think. Man, I don't know. I mean, he peaks pretty late in that New Orleans series, right?
Yeah, that's true.
He shot 14 for 14 in the clincher. So I don't know. I mean, is there an element of teams figure out how to scheme him a little better as the series go on? There might be something to that, but I don't know. I just thought Phoenix had a tough couple of road games, and I still think they're going to end up winning that series.
Finally, John, for no apparent reason, I have to ask you.
Okay.
Tyus Jones, Donovan Mitchell, Jalen Brunson. There's a number of young guards currently active in the NBA playoffs that have been linked with the New York Knicks for various reasons. The Knicks notably have been in need of a playmaker for something like 20 plus years. Is there anyone out there that is worth giving up some of the Knicks' young players for, and that can move the needle for that team, you know, as a ball handler, as a perimeter threat?
To me, the scenario that makes the most sense is John Wall in a 1-year deal, right? Because, I mean, the Knicks have set themselves up to go big game hunting, right? To use their...
Unfortunately, yes.
Young players, draft picks, expiring contracts, whatever, to trade for somebody who is a high wattage star. So to move some of that for somebody who does not move the needle for them in the meantime, I don't think really makes sense. Now, Donovan Mitchell's a different story, right? Like, if he becomes actually available by trade, yeah, then the Knicks... should go ahead, back up the truck and do that. But just to get somebody who is 10% better than having John Wall and Emmanuel Quickley or Ricky Rubio and Emmanuel Quickley, like I have a hard time seeing that really being worth the trouble for them. Like, even if they could get a sign and trade with Brunson, like they're probably giving up enough in that I'm not really sure it's worth it for them.
He is John Hollinger, national writer for The Athletic. John, thanks so much for joining Take Line. Enjoy the playoffs.
Thanks for having the show.
Oh, morning. How'd you sleep?
Amazing.
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 When did they get here?
I didn't even notice.
Mommy, I want pancakes.
Get the best sleep of your life with a little help from the experts at Ashley. Discover the all-new Tempur-Adapt Collection by Tempur-Pedic. Designed with body-conforming technology and motion absorption that helps minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt Collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
It is Monday morning, and Denver Nuggets center Nikola Jokic has officially been announced as the 2021-2022 NBA League MVP, the most valuable player, beating out Joel Embiid, Giannis, other great players in the league to win his second in a row. It was an at times acrimonious debate about who should win. All deserving candidates, but Nikola Jokic has done it again for a second straight. And here to talk to us about that is Nuggets beat writer for the Denver Post, Michael Singer. Mike, thank you for joining us.
Of course. I appreciate you guys having me. And I would just like to say from the jump, the fact that Joker has won back-to-back MVPs, that's an indictment. That means Joel Embiid, Giannis Antetokounmpo are not very good players, even though they came in second and third place in the NBA voting for this award.
Thanks a lot, Mike. That's been Take Line for today. We're going to shut it down right here, and that's going to be the soundbite for the show.
Appreciate it. All right. It was fun, guys.
So, but what do you, like a lot of this debate, first of all, what's your takeaway from this, his second MVP? And then we can talk about the way the debate about this particular award transpired over the course of the season.
I think it's a special award for Nikola. He becomes one of 13 players in NBA history to ever win back-to-back MVPs, the fifth center all time. This is the kind of guy that, I mean, this was the 41st pick in the draft. he already did more than anyone ever expected of him in the NBA. Yeah. And this dude is now among like the pantheon of NBA legends. I mean, you've seen the list. It's Wilt, it's Kareem, Bill Russell, MJ, Magic, Steph, Giannis, Steve Nash, and now Joker. I don't think, you know, let's just be honest. I don't think a lot of people, quote unquote, wanted or expected him to win a back-to-back MVP. I was just looking at, you know, that NBA GM survey at the beginning of the year that they do. They predict who's going to win the MVP in the upcoming season. He was not in the top six, according to the NBA GMs, whose job it is to evaluate this. So this dude just did more with less. I think that's the reason he won the award. He didn't have Michael Porter Jr., no Jamal Murray, and yet he dragged this team to 48 wins. You can say all you want and indict him all you want about the playoffs. But sorry, Daryl Morey, until the NBA changes its rules, this is a regular season award.
Well, so, okay, obviously in your heart and your mind, it's Jokic. But I would love to hear, say, gun to your head, you had to make a case for Embiid to win this award. What's the hype version that you're giving for Embiid to win this over Jokic this season?
I think that the best evidence you have for Joel Embiid is that he is more physically imposing and more physically dominant down low, just with his size, his obviously defensive abilities, his mobility is obviously more impressive and more significant than Nikola Jokic. I'm saying specifically around the interior, he is a beast. He is tough to deal with. And look, Nikola would be the first person to say that he respects him to the nth degree. They have a relationship off the court and they have a ton of respect for each other. So that would be it. And I see the 40-point, 10-rebound games, the most this season. That's unbelievable. And it's not like he didn't have to deal with a lot of crap in Philadelphia this year in his own right. So that would be the argument. And they finished higher. They finished with three more wins. So if you're just doing a head-to-head comparison, I think you can make the argument that he is the more physically dominant player. From a broad scope of things, and I've covered Nikola for 4 years now, the way that he impacts everything. And, like, you can't even indict his defense anymore. He is not a defensive target anymore. He's among, like, the top five centers in steals and blocks. You can't say that he's this slow-footed, plotting center who can't process a defense. Like, he can play defensively. And oh, by the way, he kills you on offense at every single level of the game. So, like I said from the jump, huge indictment on Joel Embiid. Awful basketball player. The fact that he is number two or number three, what are we even doing here? Why even, you know, let's just vote on number one and get past this.
A lot of the discourse around Nikola's MVP candidacy, specifically from critics of his candidacy, kind of centered around this idea that, like, it's an advanced stats case. I think Nick Wright was probably the most loud proponent of this particular kind of argument, that it was like, oh, the VORP people, you know, Nikola Jokic's VORP campaign. The implication, of course, being that watch this guy and you will see that he fails the eye test. Now, that whatever you think of Nikola's case, it was patently ridiculous. You watch the guy and you're like, wow, this guy's great. But did that bother the team at all? Did that get any traction in terms of, like, annoying the Nuggets? And, like, what do you think of that particular case? The idea that, oh, it's an advanced stat case for Jokic, and if you watch the guy, you're just not going to be impressed.
I think, you know, when you use that as your argument, you stake out that case on an island, you got to dig all the way down. You got to plant your flag and make that a thing. And so even if it's not a thing, which I don't think it is, because he's the first dude in NBA history with 2,000 points, 1,000 rebounds, 500 assists. I'm not even a math guy. And those are nice round numbers.
Yeah, the counting stats are really good. Yeah. Like, if you just want to do those.
So Michael Malone, Nuggets coach, is asked, what can he do to top that? And he goes, well, shit, he can get 2,500 points. He can get 1,500 rebounds. And 1,000 assists. Like, it's nuts, you know, to say it's just the calculator MVP. Come on now. To drag this team to 48 wins, it was pretty evident how, you know, the lack of depth that they had in that first round series against Golden State. It was painfully obvious. Aaron Gordon's supposed to be a number four, you know, either a number four or number five. He's not supposed to be a number two. Like, I looked it up. There was no Aaron Gordon was the lowest number two scorer in the NBA on any team across the league. He had 15 points a game. And yet they got to 48 wins. They say whatever you want about how much they tested the Golden State Warriors. I don't know how you can indict what this dude did by, you know, the day in, day out stuff. And you talk about the cumulative stuff. He won MVP last year. He was better this year with less help. In a nutshell, analytics? I didn't use any numbers there.
Mike, your energy on it, I was convinced it was Embiid before this. So, but your energy, you know, if he had a slightly less impressive season this year, he would still be in the conversation. But so you truly think this past season was more impressive than the first time he won MVP?
Yeah. And you want to know what else is crazy? Everybody thinks he came out of the woodwork. 3 years ago, he finished number four in the MVP race. It's not that crazy that this dude is doing what he's doing. This has been a slow build. He's now four-time All-Star, back-to-back MVPs. The fact that, you know, the GMs didn't think he was going to be have the potential to repeat is a curious thing. And I also think that there's a lot of, you know, if you were to give the NBA, the NBA itself some truth serum, would they want Nikola Jokic to win again? Probably not, because for marketing reasons, for rivalry reasons, we want to promote a Joel Embiid versus Nikola Jokic. That is fun. That is entertaining. And Nikola Jokic, whether he gives a damn about the MVP award or not, he just put on a better performance than he did last year in his inaugural victory. So I think he does it out of spite. I think that he's like, I don't care, but I'm still going to show you that I'm this good. And that's kind of... He did. I don't know how you indict what he did this year.
You mentioned the kind of like dearth of help around Nikola Jokic, Aaron Gordon. I loved his comments after the elimination, which I'm paraphrasing now because I'm going off the dome, was something like, you know, I've just got to make better decisions. You know, it's seeing how a good team plays. It makes me realize, you know, how I need to alter my game. And it's like, man, you've been in the league 8 years and it's just wild to be like, oh, I guess I should like make better plays. Anyway, Porter Jr. has dealt with back problems his entire career going back to college. It's the reason his draft stock fell so precipitously. Jamal coming back, you know, off of one of the most, you know, serious injuries a player can have in the NBA. Where is the help coming from, and do the Nuggets need to think about even more help for Nikola Jokic? Obviously, Gordon's here, but Porter Jr. with that balky back, how much can they count on him? Unclear what Jamal is going to give the team when he comes back, although recent history tells us that those type of knee injuries are not as serious as they once were in the NBA. Is help coming for Jokic?
Yeah, the help is on the way. And they took a long picture approach with Jamal Murray not returning this year, with Michael Porter Jr. not returning. They both flirted with comeback attempts and tried to come back at various times, and both kind of rationalized, we have a cap on what we can do this season, given that we're not fully healthy. But this offseason and going into next season, if you were to find that quote-unquote window of the Nuggets' best chances to win a championship, it is this year and next year. And the reason I say that, Michael Porter Jr. is about to begin a five-year contract that they gave to him before they needed to give him. And he has his third back surgery in 5 years. Now, again, I'm not a math guy, but those are uncomfortable numbers and uncomfortable ratios when you just committed $145 million guaranteed, $170 million over the life of this five-year deal. If you want to maximize and capitalize on Nikola Jokic's prime, which is what Michael Malone said, Tim Connolly said at the end of this year, it is these first 2 years when who knows how long Michael Porter Jr.'s back is going to be a reliable player. How long can you trust that for? And then Jamal, I think that they think he's going to return and be fully healthy. I think so too. I mean, you know, 15, 16 months off is going to do him a lot of good. I talked to Klay Thompson during the playoffs and he said it was laughable that they would even consider bringing him back, dropping him into a playoff series. That's just an unfair ask. I think a lot of people would agree with that, you know, to force a guy's hand. So, for you know, that didn't happen. I do think the cavalry's coming. I do think they're going to be healthy next year. The key, and by the way, again, without those two guys, the Nuggets had the sixth best offense in the NBA. The sixth. That's with Aaron Gordon, Will Barton, Monte Morris, who's a backup point guard starting, and 35-year-old Jeff Green as your power forward, who was never supposed to be starting at power forward. So all those things, he still does it. They, where they need to improve is defensively. They're not good enough defensively. Aaron Gordon's really the only plus defender. And then, you know, with that triangle of Joker, Jamal, and MPJ, how much do you trust them defensively? And it, are there upgrades to be made specifically in that starting unit where you can lessen the burden on Joker defensively?
Well, so, okay, I want to go back to the MVP award because I do feel like I've trashed. I was one of the NBA Twitter guys was like, it should be Embiid. So now I'm trying to redeem myself and let's celebrate the MVP award. But that's kind of my question. Cause you followed him as a person as well. And we've met his brothers. We've seen a little bit glimpses of his off court life. How was Jokic reacting to a back-to-back MVP? How is he going out and celebrate? We're obviously going to see the official, you know, acceptance of the award, but how does a Jokic feel about actually getting this MVP? Does it drive him? Is it just another, you know, accolade? Like, how is he reacting to this?
Well, how does he celebrate? I'm pretty sure he rides around the horse track at double speed. He's like, all right, Dreamcatcher, that's his favorite horse. Let's go. We got two times. So that's, I think, the first celebration. You know, I asked him this. I asked him this after game five of the Golden State series when they got eliminated. And he goes, probably I would celebrate with some music, with some beer, with my family, with my friends. And he goes, that's probably how you're supposed to do it. And I love that he hedges because he's like, how the hell? I don't know. Like, but the fact is he does know. I don't know how he got down last year when he did win it. But this time it's a lot different because he's back home in Sombor, Serbia, amongst his family and friends and amongst people where he could just like lay back and chill and do whatever he wants without worrying about being caught on camera, which is all of our losses. And I'm very sad about that. But this, like, it's funny because he claims he will tell you multiple times he's indifferent to the award, but I don't really think that he is. I think he's more indifferent than other players, and certainly Embiid has campaigned for it. Last year, Steph Curry, LeBron campaigned for it. Joker will never campaign for it. And the reason why is because I don't think he wants his legacy tied up in individual awards. He knows that it is intricately connected to how he will be viewed in history. But he, you know, coming from where he came from, a team first approach, he doesn't care about those individual accolades. He said a million times, like, I want to win titles. I want to win a championship. Like, that's what I care about. And, you know, a month or two into this season, I go, it was pretty obvious he was going to be in the running for MVP again. And I go, Nikola, how excited are you to be, you know, a part of this MVP conversation again? And he's like, can't wait, brother. Like, he cannot handle, he doesn't like the attention. He doesn't like the spotlight. And I mean, at the core of who he is, he's super humble. So to have all these accolades poured on him, he's just, that's not who he is in his nature. And that's not an indictment on other people. Other people can lean into the award if they want it or campaign for themselves. He's just not going to do that. But again, it just so happens he's that damn good where he forces everybody's hand and it's like, well, I guess he's going to win it again.
He is Mike Singer, Nuggets beat writer for the Denver Post. Thanks so much for joining us. Congratulations to Denver. It was really cool. Can't wait to see the Nuggets back in action next season, man. Thanks for joining us.
Appreciate it, guys. Thanks a lot.
That's it for us, folks. Follow and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe to Take Line Show on YouTube for exclusive video clips from this episode, plus my digital series, All Caps NBA, which airs every Friday. Check it out. Goodbye. Take Line is a Crooked Media production. The show is produced by Ryan Wallerson and Zuri Irvin. Our executive producers are myself and Sandy Drort. Engineering, editing, and sound design by the great Sarah DeWalaska and the folks at Chapter 4. And our theme music is produced by Brian Vasquez. Mia Kelman is on the Zoom for vibes, and the vibes are fantastic all the time.
Stay connected this winter with this unbeatable deal from Breezeline. Get reliable, fiber-powered internet for just $19.99 per month with all-in pricing for 2 years. But that's not all. Your first month is on us. This deal gets better with a free modem and installation, along with free Wi-Fi your way whole home coverage. Safeguard your network from cyber threats and keep all your devices connected and secured with this amazing offer. Act now. Terms and conditions apply. Offer expires March 3rd, 2024. Learn more at Breezeline.com.